Today is Thursday. It is January 4th, 2018. It's my wife's birthday. It's 11:13 in the morning. This is John Williams, the host of The Mincing Rascals. If you think The Mincing Rascals is swell, please tell your friends, share this podcast, get more folks to tune in and type in questions down below, and listen to me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN Radio.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Happy birthday, Brenda.
Happy birthday, Brenda. Happy birthday. I'll sing later. Kristen McQuarrie with the Tribune Editorial
Board. It's not going to help. She hates her birthday.
I do, too. Oh, I'm with
her. You just had one. When was yours?
It was December 26th, yeah. And I saw you, and I also hate my birthday. My husband surprised me that night by bringing some friends out.
Brenda and I were at Banderas having a drink and just killing some time, and who walked into the bar to have a glass of wine and check out her phone, but one Kristen McQuarrie.
With the sash that said birthday girl on it?
I did. I was nude. All nude except for the sash.
Mm-hmm. And the other guy is?
Oh, I'm Eric Zorn, the rapidly aging columnist from the Tribune. I appear Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays, and my 60th birthday is on Saturday.
Oh,
really?
My God.
So I'm with Brenda about this. This is a crummy time of year, and Kristen about this being a crummy time of year for birthdays.
My birthday is February 3rd. So it's the same, and I don't hate it. I'm just indifferent.
Right.
I don't care.
Don't you wish people would just ignore it?
Exactly. That's what I hate about Facebook.
Put it on Facebook?
I don't put my birthday on Facebook.
Yeah, I took mine down.
Yeah, it's like it was just annoying. And so anyway.
Boo hoo.
Is that why we're
first
here?
First world problems.
So, yes.
Here we go now. Ready? Guess what was in 48,584th place last week and is in first place this week on Amazon? Fire and Fury, Michael Wolff's Inside Trump's White House, the new book about the 45th president, set to hit bookshelves January 9th, has been excerpted, and the first reads are tantalizing. The president is suing to stop the book's release because that will really hurt sales. We've all seen bits and scraps of this. Eric, have you read much of it? And do you trust this author?
I read the excerpt that was published in New York Magazine, which I think is pretty much what most people have read.
Yeah.
Some people, I guess, have gotten their hands on the entire book. Katie Turr from NBC had an interesting excerpt that she tweeted out. But what I read was what I think a lot of people have read so far. I do trust Michael Wolff. I think he's an experienced veteran journalist whose track record is very good. There are some parts about what I read that troubled me because they were so strangely sourced. And just the example I would give is the conversation that he relates between Steve Bannon and Roger Ailes. They have lunch together, and there's this long conversation that he
quote,
and it's as though he's doing it from a recording. He doesn't say how he reproduced this. I'm thinking it's more like sort of the Truman Capote style of creative nonfiction. But when you're dealing with something as important as this story is, I think you need to explain, well, I'm recreating this, or this is the conversation as Steve Bannon remembers it. I mean, from whom did he get this?
And these are questions that are going to Ivanka and Jared see Ivanka using her role in the West Wing as a launch point to be the first female president. I've never heard that. And there's no quotes around that, and there's no sourcing of that. Is that his inference, or did somebody tell him that, or is that common knowledge that nobody else in the media?
These are the questions that are going to dog this book between now and whenever Wolf comes out and explains his methods in sourcing, because these are questions. What it means is it throws everything that he puts up there in those terms.
That's why
this
is what I've read so far.
But there are also a lot of people quoted, and there are a lot of people cited by name, and I don't think, has any of them come forward to say yet that Cohen?
I'm blanking on the name.
Katie Walsh has. Yeah.
Yes,
and other people in the past have had the same sort of criticism of his work, that he pulls quotes sort of out of his imagination that maybe have some foundational base. But just as a journalist, I mean, we are so careful when we quote people that the is in the right place. And if you have to use ellipses because you weren't sure if they said an or and, you put the ellipses in there. So to me, that's a huge red flag. Exactly what you're talking about. The direct quotes back and forth when he wasn't there, I think is really suspicious.
I think it's a book of gossip, and I can't wait to devour it. No, I'm not going to
totally agree.
I'm not going to take it as total fact or anything like that. But I suspect it probably does catch the mood. And Steve Bannon has spoken a couple of times, and he has not disavowed anything he said. in that.
And that's the big news.
Katie Walsh disavow it?
Yeah, she said she didn't say that Trump is a child.
That dealing with him was like dealing with a child. And she did do a sit-down interview with him. I think he interviewed like 200 people. So, I mean, there's some legitimacy here, of course. But it raises, to me, the same questions that have dogged him his whole career. He's talked about how in the past when he has gotten caught in lies, he sort of decides how fatal was the lie. I think our conversation is treating it as it should be. It's a lot of gossip, a lot of kind of historical fiction, nonfiction.
You know, the word I'm thinking of, Kristen, is truthiness. That's it's not entirely accurate, but it has the patina of truth.
You talk to a lot of authors, and they say that fiction can capture the truth sometimes better than nonfiction.
Yeah.
So this is somewhere in between there. I think it probably does capture the mood and probably is fairly accurate when he's describing what people who work for him feel about him. But I'm not going to fight for every quote.
And you can rehabilitate a passage like the one I discussed, this lunchtime conversation between Ailes and Bannon, just by saying at the beginning of it, and here's how the conversation went as Steve Bannon remembers it.
But he doesn't, in the excerpts that we've seen. So no. I don't care what he goes on the Today Show later and explains, here's how. He doesn't explain it in the book.
Right.
And,
no, you're good and point. Any, fair point. You're right.
People are going to read this believing that he was there, or there was a recording. And it's just, I don't know.
You know what, actually, Kristen, I think it works against him, because I think if they give the Trump supporters anything to argue about, if you can argue against anything successfully, then you can argue against all of it. You know, if you can say, well, this clearly isn't true, then why should we believe the rest of it?
It's the same tactic they're taking with Michael Flynn, yeah. Right? They're saying he admitted he's a liar, so we can't believe anything he says.
But I don't think it's a small story that the president of the United States lawyer is going to court or sending a suit to try to stop publication of this book. Right? I mean, it's as if he's the queen and the palace is upset about it. That's pretty amazing.
I think a lot of elected officials have done that or figures.
To stop publication of a book?
Yes. Jesse Jackson, Shakedown, he made it so that it was so hard to get a copy of the book that you couldn't even walk into a Barnes & Noble and get it. I think Hillary Clinton sued over a couple of the early memoirs.
Did she sue to stop them to be published?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to go any farther than that. But I don't think it's terribly unusual.
It seems striking that the president of the United States would do that. But
they may have a case against Bannon if they have a non-disclosure agreement from him during the campaign, and he's spilling what happened there. I don't think those.
But again, but that's against Bannon, not against the book, right?
I mean, yes.
The best description I read of the style that Michael Wolff uses is that he doesn't recreate scenes; he creates scenes. He feels like he was there long enough that he knew what was going on, and that's what's so tantalizing about this, isn't it? That even though we could go, that's probably not true, and I know that fact is wrong, it sort of has the ring of truth about what we would imagine the Trump administration has been like.
Eric, you might remember this. The authorized biography of Ronald Reagan was written by a guy named, I think, Edmund something, and he might even have been British. But he did that. He almost wrote a fictionalized account of Ronald Reagan, or a novelized, maybe, version of what he thought Ronald Reagan's life was like. You know, you don't remember that uproar?
I don't remember that uproar. No. I do know that this is a convention in what's called creative nonfiction. Truman Capote in Cold Blood is the classic example. I mean, he recreates entire scenes where he wasn't there, and this was just sort of considered part of the art form.
But it feels sloppy in this case. For instance,
in this case,
says,
it particularly does.
He says that
it really matters.
When they were trying to pick a chief of staff, they were running a bunch of people by him. He wanted Bannon, and Joe Scarborough said, "Oh my God, Washington will burn if Bannon is the chief of staff." Reince Priebus obviously got the job, but at one point, and the president wanted Jared Kushner, and they said, no, it can't be family. And so it was suggested to the president that he pick John Boehner. And Trump says, who's John Boehner? Okay, think about
that's,
that.
But that's totally believable.
But then they go back and they say, but if you look at Trump's Twitter record, he was referencing Boehner in tweets previous to that, so he must have known. When he said, who's John Boehner, was that sarcastic, like, he's not important enough, or who's John Boehner? That's a dismissive statement. What's the context? But the author plays it off as though Trump literally did not know who John Boehner is. But, you know, in this day and age, we can fact check that in a moment and realize that Trump does know who John Boehner is.
So will you read it?
Yeah, I'm going to read it.
Really?
Well, yeah, I am, because And I hope that my brain will remember where I got the information. I'll glean from it. But I do think it will be somewhat informative. I think it sounds hilarious. I'm very curious about it. But I'm worried that I'll put that in the same box I'm putting other facts and scraps of information, and I'll be less informed as a result. That's
he'll,
the danger.
He'll come
of
back with his own book. I mean, look,
who will?
Trump. Eventually, every president sits down and writes their own memoir. So it's not like this is going to be the mark on his presidency. I mean, I suffered through 800 pages of Bill Clinton's My Life. So I think, oh, come on.
Okay. What did you not like about My Life? Too indulgent? Too long? Too Clintonesque?
Yes. All of the above.
You weren't charmed by him and Hillary driving through the foothills of Arkansas, door to door campaigning? I mean, that side of him you don't even think about anymore. And I thought, this is a real life person. It's a guy who really had genuine ambitions, you know, good ambitions, good intentions. No.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me that the first line.
Maybe we didn't read the same book.
No, I just, my opinion of him, a one-time big supporter of his, just completely plummeted after the impeachment trial. It just did. He was a liar. So even though I did read the book, I took issue with all of the self-indulgences.
The first line of Richard Nixon's memoir is, "I was born in a house my father built."
Yeah.
And how could you not love anyone after that, right?
I actually am reading, or I started to read, and then I stopped because my father-in-law loaned it to me, and then I never got around. But the latest Nixon story, and I was charmed by him, you know, in his early days and when he was making his first run for Congress.
So, all right, I want to talk to you guys about. Pardon me, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, let's move
but
on.
While we're on the president, let's just get through a couple of these things. I want to get to what Chris Kennedy has said about Mayor Rahm Emanuel, but let's just stay on the president for a minute. He seems to have a very itchy finger on the nuclear button. Kristen, how are you following, or how upset or worried are you about nuclear war and about the president continually flicking Kim Jong-un's ear?
I'm concerned. I mean, I said this probably when we first started talking on the podcast about Trump and his tweets, that I don't worry so much about Ivanka's clothing line or the, you know, him taking pot shots at Boeing, but tempting the North Korean regime is disconcerting to me. Now, I do believe there are enough people around Trump that I'm not, you know, building a big supply in my basement of water and worrying about actual nuclear war, but it's so stupid. It's so stupid. And I know everything he tweets is stupid, but this is particularly, you know, he's risking the safety of the South Koreans. He's risking relationships with our allies, and there's no need for it. And again, this whole my button is bigger than yours. I can't stomach it. It's too much.
I was listening to some of the newscasts about it, and it sounds like it's from a comedy movie. You know, like a Will Ferrell movie. And the president today tweeting that his nuclear button was bigger than, you know, it's just comical. It's not comical, but it's just...
Well, it's metaphorical. I mean, if Trump ever could be clever, that would be one way to do it. My button's bigger than yours. My arsenal's bigger than yours.
But we did this before with the hand size,
and this
remember?
This is about nuclear war.
I know. But again, it's a reference to another piece of the anatomy. It's just so sophomoric.
Well, he was on this 17-tweet Tuesday. He was, when everybody went back to work this week, the day after New Year's, he was so anxious to start pounding away and launching big thoughts. I don't know if they're going to remember Twitter Tuesday necessarily, Eric, but he was all over the map this week.
This business with North Korea and these guys taunting one another back and forth, I'm more troubled by it than Kristen is. I'm not quite ready to lay in a supply of water and canned food, but I really feel like we are pushing ourselves closer and closer to this, to some sort of a military action against North Korea. It might be a blockade, it might be a conventional weapons attack, but those tensions are ratcheting up, and there's no need for them to ratchet up the way they are.
I don't know. I'm sorry, Eric. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I mean,
I don't know if you guys were aware on the way. Probably you were up here. The administration in South Korea announced that they were going to postpone the military exercises until after the Olympics. So
North Korea is
no. The South Korea and the U.S. their joint exercises. They're pushing back. So a conciliatory sort of approach there.
I'm optimistic about all of this. I actually think calmer heads will prevail. You know, that Kim Jong-un has his own self-interest in heart, and the United States, it has more adults in the room than the president. So I just don't see it escalating to this sort of apocalyptic scenario. You with me on that?
I am, for the most part.
Yeah.
It's just,
By the way, the president is going to on Monday at 5 p.m. For those of you Central Time, if you're listening to us on a different time zone, at 5 o'clock Monday evening, the president says he's going to announce his Worst of the Media Awards, where he will, I'm extrapolating a little bit here. It was from one of his tweets.
Is it 5 o'clock Central Time or 5 o'clock Eastern Time?
Probably Eastern Time, now that you mentioned it.
Because it said 5:00 o'clock. And I think that he must be on Eastern Time.
Now, here it is. I will be announcing, capital letters now, the most dishonest and corrupt media awards of the year on Monday at 5:00 o'clock. Subjects we'll cover.
It would be so much better if he drank, you know, and then we could blame it on drunk tweeting.
I wonder if he hasn't started. I mean, some of it, that would make a lot more sense, wouldn't it?
It would make more sense.
Subjects we'll cover: dishonesty and bad reporting in various categories from the fake news media. Stay tuned! Exclamation point. So we'll see. I don't know what that means, but Monday he's supposed to take another shot at one of the pillars of America, and that is media.
Who's he going to go after, do you think? I mean, is he going to go for like Maggie Haberman or those kind of people?
Right, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN.
But you know what? Can we acknowledge that the media has made a number of sloppy mistakes that give him room to do this? I mean, Google it. Look at all the mistakes that have been made, the retractions, the corrections that have had to have been run.
But that's it. But
the
then,
tone. You had Woodward and Bernstein on the Sunday news shows this week talking about the snarky, unnecessary, and righteous tone that the media has had toward this president.
I think that's a real danger. And I think we were talking about
Kristen's right.
That she is right. You know, and it happened. I remember when I think it happened, when the president when the candidate then took credit for ending the birther movement. He had that news conference, and the New York Times and Washington Post instantly had a headline online saying the president lied, and that was kind of the beginning of the turn. I think you're right. I mean, I don't know that it's undeserved, but I think it's going to take a long time to ever correct. And I also think the same thing with trust in truth or not truth. I mean, I think we're looking at decades before this whole institutional idea is stabilized.
There have certainly been mistakes made by the press. And one, the classic one, I guess the easiest one to remember, is the one where right after the inauguration, the reporter goes into the Oval Office and then comes back and reports that the bust of Martin Luther King has been removed. Right? Do you remember that?
Oh,
right.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. There are a million like that.
There aren't a million.
All right, not a million, but there are a lot.
But the thing about that is that reporter instantly, when he was told that he made a mistake, he retracted. We know about these mistakes because the institutions correct them. And
not all of them have. If I go through the list, because I did this not too long ago and went through some of the things that you have now institutional memory about, like crowd size on Inauguration Day. Do you know how that actually ended up? It actually ended up that they were wrong, that the person who put out the photos at the different times was actually wrong. And there have been numerous examples like that. So even if they come back and correct it, I think he can make a case, unlike any other president, that this was a hostile media environment and that he has been under more scrutiny, much of it, probably all of it, invited. But
I think generally the truthometer is on the media side, that they're credible, that they're honest, that they're hardworking, that they're letting their emotions get ahead of them. Sometimes they're rooting against the president instead of for the truth, but that mostly the media is still getting it right. Don't you agree with that, Kristen?
I would say mostly they're getting it right, but I also didn't blame the Trump administration when, for example, they stopped doing televised briefings, because the media, John, is in it for itself a lot of the time.
Okay.
Jim Acosta is standing up there to make a headline for himself.
CNN
to get on
is
television.
Failing itself.
They all do it
constantly.
They all do it. They all do it.
But are you telling me that on the inauguration day, Trump's crowd was larger than Obama's?
I'm telling you that the timing of the photo that was taken,
the side by sides,
were taken at different times.
I don't remember it that way.
I'll
trust you now because I trust you, but pardon me if I go back and look, because
no, please
my
do,
institutional
and correct
memory
me if I'm wrong, but I'm just
is that the side by sides were the same day, same time, same location, and that Obama's dwarfed President Trump's. That's what we all remember.
But this is a great example of how little mistakes in that book can derail the whole thing, because for me that issue wasn't about the actual crowd size. It was about Sean Spicer being forced out there the next day and starting his tenure by lying about things. that to me was the story, not that fewer people showed up to see Donald Trump.
Yes, that they were upset that's how he started his first.
Right.
So he was very adversarial, too. And I understand that. But I sit and watch in a lot of these cable television shows every single day. It is a bashing of him that I just have not seen.
Jake Tapper, I think, is really in some ways maybe coming to his own or is a perfect example of this, because I think he's a pretty reliable host on CNN, but he's also very directly, very willing to call them out and call them liars and do it sometimes in a very snarky way. So I think that's a good example of someone who's probably doing good work, but is tilted into a fashion that he wouldn't have before.
CNN has fallen into the clickbait thing where they'll say, here are the top 10 most outrageous lines from President Trump's speech or from Sarah Sanders' press conference. And you just want to click through, and then they've highlighted the lines and you click through, and it's very clickable and very media friendly and I think it's not true journalism. I don't know what the definition of that is anymore, but I hate to see them go down that road.
There's a broader danger that we're talking about here, which is if you convince a third of the public that nothing they read in the conventional media can they trust, and that you call into question what facts are, what the actual truth is, what the actual the data that we're arguing about is, then you make democracy itself kind of impossible. Like, how do we resolve disputes if nobody can agree on some sort of basic fundamental facts? And who do we trust to give us those facts but, our mainstream media organizations? And I think that they are 99% correct. And that they correct 75% of the times that they're wrong.
It's what they choose to spend time focusing on, like Melania's shoes or the tone. I don't think that they are out there purposely putting out inaccurate information. I think most of the time it's the choice of what they're writing about.
Do you think on balance the Trump administration has been treated unfairly?
On balance, I think that they don't get the benefit of the doubt, and they haven't from the beginning.
Have they earned the benefit of the doubt?
Obama didn't have to earn it. I would say that within the first three or four days of Sean Spicer coming out and being so confrontational, rather than the press being self-reflective and getting outside of their groupthink and talk to some of the conservative members of the press corps in Washington and how they were ridiculed and mocked for all these years because they weren't part of the groupthink. And I think other administrations easily have gotten a benefit of the doubt that this one hasn't.
I'll give you one example. When Clinton came in, remember the stories about all the W's being taken off the keyboards and the Oval or the
West Wing? That's part
the
of my West institutional being, memory of that event.
The West Wing being trashed and all of that stuff. Well, you had Ari Fleischer coming out every day and not dismissing it, but not saying it wasn't true. A lot of it wasn't true. I guess that's the end of a presidency, not the beginning. They gave Bush the benefit of the doubt, but not Clinton. Strike that bad example.
That's okay.
We'll edit this out in post. Don't worry.
Here's the next topic for you guys to real quick run through, and it's more important than the time I'm about to give it. But Chris Kennedy, running for governor, says that Mayor Rahm Emanuel is intentionally marginalizing people of color in Chicago, pushing them out of the city, literally. Does he really mean that, and do we agree with him? Steve, what's your read on this one?
Well, what he's saying is that the policies of gentrification in Bronzeville and elsewhere, and the closing of schools in Englewood and mental health facilities are making it harder for poor black people to stay in Chicago. And he's saying that he said this morning on WGN Radio, I don't know what's in the mayor's heart, but he's at the helm, and so he's responsible for this. I think he's a candidate trying to light a fuse. I mean, I think he's trying to find an issue. I don't want to say that it was cynically political, but I think he's trying to find something that would resonate. I don't doubt that he believes it.
He said, well, cynical or not, it's true.
Yeah, he said that if it's slander, defense of slander is truth. And what I said was true.
How did you hear all of this?
I agree with Steve that he has to differentiate himself among this field of Democratic candidates. And they're all sort of in the machine in some way, and he isn't. So this is a way for him to strike back. But I would say in the margins, so I don't believe Rahm Emanuel is a racist person. I don't believe in his heart that he is intentionally pushing black and brown people out of the city. But I think lack of good policy has done that. I think not calling out Joe Berrios and a first in a wrong property tax assessment system that we all know has been crooked for all of these years.
He
has not done that. He has. They closed schools in many of these communities because they're emptying out, and they emptied out 15 and 20 years ago. And so Rahm is not responsible for that. But during his first 6 years in office, how much attention did he give downtown, and how much attention did he give to Chatham, where you had stable middle-class black families who left because of crime? So I think it's kind of around the edges. There's some accuracy there, but I don't like the idea that this was all intentional. I think a lot of it is policy-driven and just bad policy.
You said it was strategic, and that's the thing that I thought, I'm like you. I think, yeah, those actions have consequences, but you're actually putting it as the mayor's intent, and I think that's where you're crossing the line. You're not helping yourself.
It's perfectly possible to raise this issue, the kind of issues that Kristen raises, and to talk about what is causing, you know, black flight from Chicago. What can we do to bolster the neighborhoods that they're leaving, and so on? I mean, this is you know, the big broad problem of any urban mayor, but to turn that into an intentional decision to try to drive black people out of Chicago is to really inflame a situation in a way that I don't think is going to be helping him. It might help him in the African American community for votes, and the Kennedy name is still pretty good in the African American community. I don't know that it helps you if it's a statewide election. Maybe Chris Kennedy runs for mayor after this. Maybe that's going to be the long game, because I don't. His campaign, otherwise, it's like the other day there was this, you know, his whole issue is supposed to be violence. He's got Rod Joy running with him, the guy whose son was tragically killed. And the idea was that they were going to go after this violence problem. And reporters asked him, well, what specific things are you going to do to address this violence problem? And he immediately pivots to Joe Berrios and the whole property tax thing, saying, well, I'm going to make sure that state lawmakers can't be property tax attorneys. And this is connected how to violence.
Yeah.
I mean, his campaign does not seem like it's getting the kind of traction that it's going to need. So I'm thinking maybe he's got a long game here. I don't know, because the short game has not been very good.
I give him more credit than that, because it really bothers me that Democratic leaders in this state continue to ignore what is, according to even a lawsuit that's been filed, institutionalized racism in the city through the property tax system, through the public school system, lack of school choice. All of these policies that the Democrats have pushed forward have harmed these communities, in my mind. And I don't think he was artful in the way Kennedy, in the way that he explained it. But I applaud him for calling them out. And Rahm Emanuel, in his response, didn't address. He still hasn't addressed the property tax system.
He's not around.
He doesn't get asked the substance, or maybe he's getting asked the substantive question, and he pivots. But he doesn't deal with the substance of what Chris Kennedy said. He then pivots and makes it all about Chris Kennedy, and oh, how pathetic that this is. He has to throw these community members under the bus. Deal with the substance of what he's saying, and he hasn't done that.
Steve's getting fidgety. It means it's time for us to wrap up
the podcast. I know. We got to go.
And so we're going to do a bonus round after you leave on our predictions. But Steve, let's do the recommendations port real quick. What is your recommendation? Something you're reading, watching, listening to, or consuming?
I've been watching The Marvelous Miss Maisel, which is a show on, I think it's on Netflix.
Netflix,
and it's written by and produced by the people who did Gilmore Girls. So this is more of an adult version. It's a couple. The husband wants to be a stand-up comedian. Jewish family. The husband's terrible. They end up breaking up, and the wife finds out that when she's drunk, she's very funny. And so then we sort of watch her find her own. It's been pretty good. And I think the lead is from Highland Park, but The Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Is that Amy Sherman Palladino? What's her name? The woman who did...
Palladino is the... Yeah.
Yeah. Johanna watched that. She loved it. So.
No kidding.
It was a great show, yeah.
What's your recommendation?
So AT&T has been out at my house for 7 days. No TV, no internet.
Are you kidding?
No.
Because of the cold?
Robinson Crusoe.
Initially, we thought it was the cold. Then they keep saying they have all the... It's kind of pocketed areas.
Are you kidding?
No.
Your neighborhood has been out of cable?
Not even my whole neighborhood. My block, and then other people who have AT&T U-verse.
And they haven't fixed that?
And they haven't fixed it. So for 7 days, we've been like walking, you know, playing a lot of cards and Jenga. And
Brendan
all that,
and I played solitaire. We were actually playing solitaire when we first moved in, and we were like 2 weeks without cable. It was longer. Maybe it was a year. It felt like a very long time.
Yeah.
And we actually started playing card games.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of fun.
It seemed like a column for you. You should write it.
I don't know. Anyway. My other thing real quick I want to plug is the Tribune Editorial Board. We started a hashtag on Twitter and Facebook, hashtag Illinois Exodus. And we want to hear your stories. If you've left Illinois or thinking about Illinois, why? And we're sort of collecting that because it gives us a good gauge on why we keep losing population and people who keep saying it's for the weather. Mm-mm. Don't think so.
Illinois Exodus. So if I'm tweeting or on Facebook, use that hashtag and you guys will mine that stuff?
Yes. And if you want to see what people have responded so far, plug it in and you'll see all the people and why they've left and why they're taking their retirement income and wealth and even some of them uprooting their kids out of school and moving to different.
Are we also asking why people stay? Who stay?
No, I don't care.
I know because I as a person who recently just did the exact opposite of all of that. I hate to hear these stories. I hate to see this happening.
Mm-hmm.
Will that mean that my property value or taxes will go up or down?
You have fewer people paying them.
Yeah, it'll probably go up.
And value will go down, your taxes will go up.
Well, that's great. Eric, your recommendation is?
What we did on vacation on nights, we were just in Costa Rica and there's Wi-Fi everywhere, and unlike in Kristen's neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we were able to, watch the first season of an NBC series called The Good Place. Have you seen it?
Yeah, it is amazing. For network TV, especially.
Network TV is very funny.
Ted Danson.
Well, it's Ted Danson. We watched the first couple. I'd heard that it was really great, so I insisted that we push through the first couple because the premise seems kind of weak in a way, that this woman dies and ends up in the good place. And everyone's supposed to be, but she's not supposed to be there. She realized she's a terrible person and she's not supposed to be here. And this spins out hilariously, and I hear the second season's even better. So
yeah, it is. The second season sort of picks up with the resolution to that point you brought out, and then goes further.
Right,
it's really clever.
So we watched the entire season.
You did,
yeah.
The first season. And now here comes number two, huh? Over the break between Christmas and New Year's, we did a triple feature one day at our house, and I'm actually going to charge my producer, Griffin Filipich, on Saturday with coming up with some of those sort of creature comfort, I'm in the cold, I'm just going to watch some movies, what are some good movies that never disappoint on rewatching, and two that were the first two in our triple feature that I want to re-recommend are The Edge of 17.
Okay.
Which was a great movie last week, coming of age about a girl in school and her trauma and life. And it's so funny. And I don't know anything about teenage girls, but it sure struck me as being true. Such good acting, such good writing. And then Inglourious Basterds, which I haven't watched in a long time. It's an odd double feature, but we are on our Saturday show going to have the list of movies that if you went back and watched, you will not be disappointed. And those were two that I thought were really
fun. Do you remember which services they're on?
Let's see. I was watching them on Netflix. I don't know how I do TV. I have this on-demand button, and if I hit that, and then I go to movies.
I don't know how I do the TV. I'll just have this button.
And I have Netflix, too, but
Internet
does that mean
machine?
We have this box, and it's in the middle of our house, and it has a cord, and things come out of it. All right.
Predictions.
That is this week's. Okay, so should we wrap up? Do you guys have like 5 more minutes?
I kind of don't.
Okay, Eric and I will do it.
I'll channel.
Then let me do this. Thank you, Kristen McQuarrie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Steve Bertrand, Eric Zorn, and engineer is Ben Cortez. The Mincing Rascals are produced by Elif Garris. We will post adjacent to this the bonus round, and that is the predictions for the year. Eric and I will zip through the gang's answers. And
we have Kristen's answers?
We'll show off how smart I am.
Yes, I do.
In our bonus podcast.
I'll handle the Tribune side of this. I'll handle Kristen and Scott. And myself, and you handle Bertrand, okay?
Click through, play at home. That's our bonus podcast. We'll drop another one on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNradio.com. Just click on the WGN Plus tab. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus Podcast Network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on the John Williams Show on WGN Radio.